PHADO. Or don't you think so? What you say is entirely likely. And those who valued injustice and tyranny and plunder above all slip into the bodies of wolves and hawks and kites. Or where else would we say such souls go? No doubt, said Sebes, into creatures like that. So it's clear enough, he said, where each of the others would go to, following the likeness of their practices. Clear enough, he said, of course. So the happiest of these, and the ones going to the best place, are those who have practiced the ordinary civic virtue people call temperance and justice, which comes from habit and practice, without philosophy or reason. How are these the happiest? Because it's likely they return again into some similarly organized, gentle species, bees, perhaps, or wasps, or ants, or even back into the human race and become decent, moderate men. Likely enough. But to enter the race of the gods is not permitted to anyone who hasn't practiced philosophy and departed entirely pure, only to the lover of learning. And this, my friends Simmias and Sebes, is exactly why true philosophers hold back from all the bodily desires and master them and don't surrender themselves to them, not out of fear of ruining their households or of poverty, the way most people, the money lovers, do, nor out of dread of dishonor or disgrace, the way the power lovers and honor lovers do. That's why they hold back from them. No, that wouldn't be fitting for them, Socrates, said Sebes. No, indeed, by Zeus, he said. So for all these reasons, Sebes, those who care at all for their own soul and don't live shaping their lives around the body, bid farewell to all that and don't walk the same road as people who don't know where they're going. Instead, believing they mustn't act against philosophy and the liberation and purification it offers, they turn and follow wherever it leads. How so, Socrates? I'll tell you, he said. Lovers of learning know that when philosophy takes hold of their soul, it finds it literally bound up and glued fast within the body, forced to examine the things that are through the body as through a prison cell rather than by itself, through itself, and wallowing in utter ignorance. And philosophy sees the terrible cunning of this imprisonment, that it works through desire, so that the prisoner himself becomes his own chief accomplice in being bound. PHADO. So as I was saying, lovers of learning know that when philosophy takes hold of their soul in that condition, it gently encourages it and tries to set it free, showing that observation through the eyes is full of deception, and observation through the ears and the other senses is full of deception too, and persuading the soul to withdraw from the senses except so far as it must use them, and urging it to gather and collect itself into itself, and to trust nothing but itself, whatever it, alone by itself, understands of any reality by itself, and to consider nothing true that it examines through other means, since such things vary from one setting to another, the former sort of thing being perceptible and visible, the latter, what the soul itself sees, being intelligible and invisible. Since the soul of the true philosopher believes it shouldn't resist this liberation, it holds itself back, as far as it can, from pleasures and desires and pains and fears, reasoning that whenever someone feels pleasure or fear or pain or desire intensely, the harm isn't simply what one might suppose, falling ill, say, or wasting money through indulging desires, but something else, the greatest and most extreme of all evils, which one suffers and doesn't even reckon with. What is that, Socrates? Said Sebes, that every human soul, whenever it feels intense pleasure or pain about something, is forced at the same time to believe that whatever caused this feeling most strongly is the clearest and truest thing there is, when it isn't. And this is especially true of visible things, isn't it? Certainly. And isn't it in this very experience that the soul gets most tightly bound by the body? How so? Because each pleasure and pain, like a nail, pins the soul to the body and rivets it there, and makes it bodily, so that it comes to believe that whatever the body says is true. For by sharing the body's opinions and taking pleasure in the same things, it's forced, I think, to become like the body in character and habit, and never to arrive purely in Hades, but always to depart full of the body, so that it soon falls back into another body and, as if sown there, takes root. And because of all this, it has no share in the company of the divine and pure and uniform. That's the truest thing you've said, Socrates, said Sebes. For these reasons, then, Sebes, The rightful lovers of learning are disciplined and courageous, not for the reasons most people give. Or do you think otherwise? Phaedo. No, I certainly wouldn't think that. That's not how the soul of a philosopher would reason. It wouldn't imagine that while philosophy must undo these bonds, the soul, once freed, should hand itself back over to pleasures and pains and bind itself up again, doing an endless task like some Penelope working her loom in reverse. No, such a soul secures a calm apart from these disturbances, follows reasoning and stays always within it, gazing on what is true, divine, and beyond opinion and feeding on that. It believes it must live this way as long as it lives, and when it dies, arriving at what is akin to itself and of that same nature, it will be free of human troubles. After such an upbringing, Simias and Sebes, it has nothing terrible to fear, that once separated from the body it might be torn apart, scattered by the winds, blown away and gone, existing nowhere anymore. When Socrates had said this, there was silence for a long while. Socrates himself seemed, as far as one could tell, still absorbed in what had been said, and so were most of us. But Sebes and Simias were talking quietly to each other. Socrates noticed and asked, "What is it? Do you feel something was said inadequately? There are still plenty of grounds for doubt and objection in it, if someone means to examine it thoroughly. If you two are considering something else, never mind. But if you're stuck on some point in what's been said, don't hesitate to speak up yourselves and go through it. If you see some way it might have been put better, and include me too, if you think I can help you find your way more easily." Simias said, "Well, Socrates, I'll tell you the truth. Each of us has been stuck for a while now, and each has been pushing the other to ask you, because we're eager to hear your answer but reluctant to trouble you, afraid it might be unwelcome given your present circumstances." Socrates laughed softly at this and said, "Simias, that's rich. I'd have a hard time persuading other people that I don't consider my present fate a misfortune, when I can't even persuade you too. You're afraid I'm in a worse mood now than earlier in my life. It seems you think I'm a poorer prophet than the swans, who, when they sense that they must die, sing then more than ever, and more beautifully than before, rejoicing that they are about to go to the god whose servants they are." Phaedo. But people, because of their own fear of death, tell lies about the swans too. They say the swans, grieving over death, sing their last song out of sorrow. They don't stop to consider that no bird sings when it's hungry or cold or suffering some other pain. Not even the nightingale or the swallow or the hoopoe, which people also claim sing out of sorrow. But it doesn't seem to me that these birds sing because they're in pain, and neither do the swans. I think that because they belong to Apollo, they have the gift of prophecy, and knowing in advance the good things in Hades, they sing and rejoice on that day more than ever before. And I count myself a fellow servant of the swans, consecrated to the same God, with no worse a gift of prophecy from our master than theirs, and no less cheerful about leaving this life than they are. So for that reason, feel free to say and ask whatever you like, as long as the 11 of Athens allow it. "Well said," Simias replied. "I'll tell you what troubles me, and then Sebes here can say where he doesn't accept what's been argued. It seems to me, Socrates, that on matters like these, achieving clear certainty in this life is either impossible or extremely difficult, and yet not to test in every way what's said about them, and not to give up before one has examined the question from every angle and run out of options, is the mark of a very feeble man. On such questions one ought to accomplish one of these things, learn how the truth stands or discover it oneself, or if that's impossible, then at least take the best and least refutable of human accounts, and riding on that as if on a raft, brave the danger of sailing through life, unless someone could make the crossing more safely and with less risk on some sturdier vessel, some divine account. And so now I won't be ashamed to ask, since you yourself invite it, and I won't blame myself later for not saying now what I think. Because, Socrates, when I examine what's been said, both on my own and together with Sebes here, it doesn't seem to me to have been argued adequately." Socrates said, "Perhaps you're right, my friend. But tell me where exactly it falls short." Phaedo. "Here," he said, In the very point where one might make this same argument about attunement and a lyre and its strings, that the attunement is something invisible, bodiless, altogether beautiful and divine, present in the tuned lyre, while the lyre itself and its strings are bodies, bodily, composite, earthy, akin to what is mortal. Now suppose someone breaks the lyre, or cuts and snaps the strings, and then insists, using your same argument, that the attunement must still exist and can't have perished, for there'd be no way for the lyre to still exist with its strings broken, and the strings themselves, being mortal in nature, to still exist, while the attunement, akin and related to what is divine and immortal, has perished, perished before the mortal thing itself. Rather, he'd say, the attunement itself must still exist somewhere, and the wood and strings will rot away long before anything happens to it. And indeed, Socrates, I think you yourself have considered this, that we tend to suppose the soul is something very much like this, that as our body is held in tension and bound together by hot and cold, dry and wet, and things of that sort, our soul is a blending and attunement of these very things, whenever they're blended together well and in the right proportion. If then the soul turns out to be a kind of attunement, clearly, whenever our body is relaxed or strained beyond measure by illnesses and other afflictions, the soul must at once perish, however divine it may be, just as other attunements perish, both those in musical notes and those in the works of craftsmen generally, while the remains of each body last a long time until they're burned up or rot away. So consider what we should say in response to this argument. If someone claims the soul, being a blending of the elements in the body, perishes first of all in what we call death. Socrates looked at him steadily, as he often did, and smiled. What Simmias says is fair enough, he said. If any of you is more resourceful than I am, why didn't he answer? He does seem to have laid hold of the argument rather well. Still, I think that before answering, we should first hear what fault Cebes here finds with the argument, so that in the time it takes, we can think over what to say, and then, once we've heard them both, either agree with them if they seem to be in tune with the truth, or if not, defend the argument on its behalf. Come then, Cebes, he said, tell us what's been troubling you and making you doubt. I'll tell you, said Cebes. Phaedo. It seems to me that the argument is still in the same place, and has, as we said before, the same fault to answer for. That our soul existed even before it came into this visible form. I don't take back that this has been shown quite elegantly, and if it's not too bold to say, quite adequately. But that it still exists somewhere even after we die, that I don't think has been shown. I don't agree with Simmias' objection that the soul isn't stronger and longer lasting than the body. On all these points, I think it differs enormously from the body. So then the argument might say, why do you still doubt, when you see that after a man dies, the weaker part of him still exists? Doesn't it seem necessary to you that the longer lasting part should still be preserved for that same length of time? Well, consider this point and see if there's anything in it, because it seems I too, like Simmias, need an image. It seems to me that this is rather like someone saying about an old weaver who has died, that the man hasn't perished but exists somewhere safe, and offering as proof the cloak he wove and wore himself, which is still intact and hasn't perished. And if someone doubted him, he'd ask which lasts longer, a man or a cloak in use and worn regularly. And when the answer comes back that the man lasts much longer, he'd think he had proven that the man, of all things, must surely still be safe, since the shorter-lived thing hasn't perished. But I don't think that's how it is, Simmias. Think it over yourself, what I'm saying. Anyone would recognize that whoever says this is talking nonsense. Because this weaver, having worn out and woven many such cloaks, outlived all of those many cloaks, but died before the last one. And that doesn't make a man any inferior to a cloak or weaker. And I think the soul stands to the body in just this same relation. And anyone saying the same things about them would seem to me to be saying something reasonable, that the soul is long-lasting, while the body is weaker and shorter-lived. But he might add that each soul wears out many bodies, especially if it lives many years, for if the body flows and perishes while the person is still living, and the soul is always reweaving what wears out, then it would necessarily follow that whenever the soul perishes, it happens to be wearing its last garment, and it perishes before that one alone. And once the soul has perished, then finally the body would show its weak nature and quickly rot away and vanish. PHADO. And so this argument doesn't yet give us grounds to feel confident that once we die, our soul still exists somewhere. Suppose someone granted the speaker even more than you've granted, allowed not only that our souls existed in the time before we were born, but also that nothing prevents some souls from continuing to exist after we die and existing in the future and being born again many times over and dying again. Since the soul is by nature strong enough to endure many births, but even granting all that, he might refuse to concede this further point. That the soul doesn't suffer wear from its many births, and that in the end, in one of its deaths, it perishes utterly. And this death, this dissolution of the body which brings ruin to the soul, no one, he might say, could know when it happens, since none of us can perceive it. And if that's how things are, then no one facing death has any right to be confident without being foolish, unless he can prove that the soul is altogether immortal and indestructible. Otherwise, anyone who is about to die must always be afraid for his own soul, that in this present separation from the body it might perish utterly. All of us, hearing them say this, felt distressed, as we said to each other afterward, because we had been thoroughly convinced by the earlier argument, and now they seem to stir us up again and cast us into doubt, not only about what had already been said, but about what was still to come, making us wonder whether we were worthless judges of the matter, or whether the subject itself simply admitted no certainty.
ECHSERATES.
By the gods, Fido, I sympathize with you. Even now, hearing you tell it, I find myself asking, what argument can we still trust? The argument Socrates gave, so persuasive as it was, has now fallen into doubt. This idea that our soul is some kind of attunement has a remarkable hold on me, now and always. Hearing it again just now reminded me that I had already believed something like it myself before. So I badly need some other argument, starting fresh, to persuade me that the soul of someone who dies doesn't die along with him. So tell me, for God's sake, how did Socrates take up the argument? And did he too, as you say you all did, show any sign of distress, or did he come to its defense calmly? Did he defend it adequately, or only partially? Tell us everything, as precisely as you can. Yes, Echecrates, and though I'd marveled at Socrates many times before, I never admired him more than I did that day, being there. That he had something to say, well, that's not so strange, perhaps. But what amazed me most was, first, how gladly and warmly and appreciatively he took in the young men's argument. Then how sharply he noticed what we'd suffered from those arguments. And then how well he healed us, calling us back as if we'd fled the field defeated and urging us to follow along and examine the argument together.
How did he do it?
Tell you, I happened to be sitting on his right on a low stool beside the bed and he was sitting well above me. So he stroked my head and gathered up the hair at my neck. He liked to play with my hair whenever the chance came and said, tomorrow perhaps, Fido, you'll cut off these beautiful locks. It seems so, Socrates, I said. Not if you listen to me. What then? I said. Today, he said, I'll cut off mine and you those if our argument dies on us and we can't bring it back to life. And if I were you and the argument slipped away from me, I'd swear an oath like the Argives not to let my hair grow again until I'd won my rematch against the argument of Simmias and Cebes. I said, they say not even Heracles is a match for two. Then call on me, he said, as your Iolaus while there's still daylight. I call on you then, I said, not as Heracles, but as Iolaus calling on Heracles. It won't make any difference, he said. But first let's guard against a certain danger. What danger? I said. That we not become, he said, haters of argument, the way some people become haters of humanity. There's no worse thing that can happen to a person than to come to hate argument. Hatred of argument and hatred of people arise the same way. Hatred of people creeps in when someone trusts another completely, without real skill in judging people, believing him to be entirely true, sound, and reliable, and then a little later finds him corrupt and untrustworthy, and then another one the same way. And when this happens to someone often, and especially at the hands of those he'd have counted closest and dearest, he ends up, worn down by repeated blows, hating everyone, and believing there's nothing sound in anybody at all. Haven't you noticed this happening? I certainly have, I said. Well then, he said, isn't it a shameful thing and plain that such a person was trying to deal with people without any skill in human affairs? For if he'd used some skill in dealing with them, he'd have judged the matter as it really stands, that the very good and the very bad are each very few, and those in between are the most. How do you mean? I said. It's like it is, he said, with the very small and the very large. Do you think anything is rarer than finding a person or a dog, or anything else, that's extremely large or extremely small? Or extremely fast or slow, or ugly or beautiful, or white or black? Haven't you noticed that in all such cases, the extremes at either end are rare and few, while the ones in between are abundant and many? I certainly have, I said. So don't you think, he said, that if a contest in wickedness were held, very few would come out on top there too? Likely so, I said. Likely indeed, he said. But in this respect, arguments aren't like people. Here I was simply following your lead just now. Rather, the resemblance is this. When someone trusts some argument to be true without having the skill to judge arguments, and then a little later it seems false to him, sometimes rightly, sometimes not, and then another, you know how it is, especially with those who have spent their time on arguments that argue both sides of everything. Eventually they think themselves the wisest of all, and imagine they alone have grasped that nothing at all is sound or stable, neither among things nor among arguments, but that everything that is turns up and down exactly as in the Euripus, and never stays put for any time at all. What you say is entirely true, I said. Then, Phaedo, he said, wouldn't it be a pitiful thing if, when there is some argument that is true and stable and can be understood, a person who then runs into certain arguments that seem at one time true and at another time not, doesn't blame himself or his own lack of skill, but ends up, because of the pain of it, gladly shifting the blame away from himself onto the arguments themselves, and spends the rest of his life hating and abusing arguments. And so is robbed of the truth and knowledge of the things that are. By Zeus, I said, that would be pitiful indeed. So first of all, he said, let's guard against this, and not let into our minds the idea that there's likely nothing sound in arguments, but rather that we ourselves are not yet sound, and that we must be brave and eager to become sound, you and the others for the sake of your whole life still ahead, and I myself for the sake of death itself, since as things stand I'm in danger of behaving about this very matter, not like a lover of wisdom, but like the utterly uneducated, who simply love to win. For when people like that dispute about something, they don't care at all how the matter they're arguing about actually stands. What they're eager for is that the position they themselves have staked out should seem right to those present. And I think that right now I differ from them only in this one respect. I won't be eager to make what I say seem true to those present, except as a side effect, but rather to make it seem so to myself, as much as possible. For I reckon it this way, my dear friend, see how self-interested this is, if what I say happens to be true, then it's good to be persuaded of it. But if there's nothing at all for someone who has died, then at least for this time before death itself I'll be less unpleasant to the people here by my grieving, and this folly of mine won't last on with me. That would be a bad thing, but will perish shortly after. So prepared, Simmias and Cebes, he said, I come to the argument. But you, if you listen to me, will give little thought to Socrates and much more to the truth. If I seem to you to say something true, agree with it. If not, resist it with every argument you have, taking care that in my eagerness I don't deceive both myself and you alike, and fly off leaving my sting behind like a bee. Well, we must press on, he said. First, remind me of what you were saying, if I don't seem to remember it. Simmias, I believe, distrusts and fears that the soul, though more divine and more beautiful than the body, might nonetheless perish first, being a kind of harmony. Cebes, it seemed to me, agreed with me on this much, that the soul lasts longer than the body, but held that this remains unclear to everyone. Whether the soul, after wearing out many bodies many times over and leaving behind the last body, might not then itself perish, and this very thing be death, the destruction of the soul, since the body, at least, never stops perishing all the time. Is there anything else, Simmias and Cebes, that we need to examine besides this? Both agreed that this was so. Well then, he said, do you accept all the earlier arguments, or some but not others? Some, they said, but not others. What do you say, then, he said, about that argument in which we claim that learning is recollection, and that if this is so, our soul must necessarily exist somewhere else before it was bound within the body? For my part, said Sebes, I was wonderfully persuaded by it at the time, and now I stand by it as by no other argument. And I too, said Simeas, feel the same way, and I'd be quite surprised if I ever came to think differently about that one. And Socrates said, But you're bound, my Theban friend, to think differently if this belief still holds, that harmony is a composite thing, and that the soul is a kind of harmony made up out of the things strung together in the body. For surely you won't accept your own claim that a harmony existed already composed before the things existed out of which it had to be composed. Will you accept that? Not at all, Socrates, he said. Do you notice then, he said, that this is what you end up saying when you claim the soul existed before it came into a human shape and body, and yet also that it's composed of things that don't yet exist. For harmony isn't the sort of thing you're comparing it to. Rather, the lyre and its strings and its notes come into being first, still unattuned, and only last of all is the harmony put together, and it's the first thing to be destroyed. So how will this argument of yours harmonize with that one? Not at all, said Simeas. And yet, he said, it's fitting that it should be in tune, if any argument is to be in tune with the one about harmony. It is fitting, said Simeas. Well then, this one is not in tune with yours. So consider which of the two arguments you choose, that learning is recollection, or that the soul is a harmony. The former, Socrates, by far, he said. For this one came to me without proof, resting on a certain plausibility and attractiveness, which is why it appeals to most people too. But I'm well aware that arguments that base their proofs on mere plausibility are frauds, and if one isn't on guard against them, they deceive very thoroughly in geometry and everywhere else as well. But the argument about recollection and learning was stated on the basis of a hypothesis worth accepting. For it was said, I believe, that our soul exists even before it comes into the body, just as its very essence, which bears the name of what it is, exists, and this I've accepted, I'm convinced, on sufficient and correct grounds. So it seems I'm bound, for these reasons, to accept neither from myself nor from anyone else the claim that the soul is a harmony. What about this then, Simeas, he said, looking at it this way? Do you think it fitting for a harmony, or any other composite, to be in some other condition than that of the things out of which it's composed? Not at all. Nor, I suppose, to do anything, or to undergo anything, beyond what those components do or undergo. He agreed. Then it isn't fitting for a harmony to lead the things out of which it's composed, but rather to follow them. He agreed to this too. So a harmony is very far from being able to move, or sound, or be opposed in any other way to its own parts. Very far indeed, he said. Well then, isn't each harmony by nature just whatever it's been tuned to be? I don't follow, he said. I mean, he said, if it's tuned more and to a greater degree, if that's even possible, wouldn't it be more of a harmony and a greater one? And if less, and to a lesser degree, wouldn't it be less of one and a lesser one? Certainly. Is this true of the soul, then, that one soul is, even in the smallest degree, more or less this very thing, soul, than another? Not in the least, he said. Come then, by Zeus, one soul is said to possess intelligence and virtue, and to be good, another folly and depravity, and to be bad. And is this said truly? Truly indeed. Now, of those who hold that the soul is a harmony, what will anyone say these things, virtue and vice, actually are present in souls? Will he say there's some further harmony and disharmony? And that the good soul, being itself a harmony, contains within itself harmony that it is, yet another harmony, while the bad one is itself unattuned and contains no further harmony within it? I can't say, said Simeas. But clearly something of that kind is what a person holding that view would say. But it's already been agreed, he said, that no soul is any more or less soul than another, and this agreement means precisely that no harmony is any more or to a greater degree, or less or to a lesser degree, harmony than another harmony. Isn't that so? Certainly. And that whatever is no more, and no less a harmony is neither more nor less attuned, is that so? It is. And what is neither more nor less attuned has no greater or lesser share of harmony, but an equal share. An equal share, So then, since one soul is, in this very respect, being soul, no more and no less than another, it's also no more and no less attuned. Just so. And being in this condition, it would have no greater share of either disharmony or harmony. No, it wouldn't. And being in this condition again, could one soul have any greater share of vice or virtue than another, if vice is disharmony and virtue is harmony? No greater share at all. More than that, Simias, by strict logic, no soul would have any share in vice at all if it really is an attunement. For an attunement, being completely and purely just that, attunement, could never take on any lack of attunement. No, it couldn't. And surely a soul, being completely and purely a soul, could never take on vice either. How could it, given what we've said? So by this argument, all souls of all living things will turn out equally good, if it's true that souls are all alike by nature, just this one thing, soul. That's how it looks to me, Socrates, he said. And do you think it's sound, said Socrates, for the argument to say this, and would it have to end up saying it if the hypothesis that soul is an attunement were correct? Not in the least, he said. Well then, he said, of all the things in a human being, would you say anything else rules them besides the soul, especially a wise soul? No, I wouldn't. Does it rule by yielding to the body's feelings, or by opposing them? I mean something like this. When there's heat and thirst in the body, the soul pulls the opposite way, toward not drinking, and when there's hunger, toward not eating. And we see it opposing the body in countless other ways, too, don't we? Certainly. Now, didn't we agree earlier that an attunement, if it really is one, could never sound contrary to the tensions, slackenings, pluckings, or any other affections of the very things it's composed from, but must follow them and never govern them? We agreed to that, of course we did. Well then, doesn't the soul now appear to us to do the complete opposite, governing all the very things people say it's composed from, opposing almost all of them throughout life, and lording it over them in every way, sometimes punishing them harshly and painfully, through physical training and medicine, and sometimes more gently, sometimes threatening and sometimes admonishing, addressing the appetites, the angers, and the fears as though it were one thing talking to another, altogether separate thing. That's just what Homer wrote in the Odyssey, where he says of Odysseus, he struck his chest and rebuked his heart with these words, "Endure, my heart, you've borne worse than this before." Do you think he wrote that thinking of the soul as an attunement, something that would be driven by the body's feelings, rather than as something that drives and masters them, something far too divine a thing to be a mere attunement? Yes, by Zeus, Socrates, that's how it seems to me too. So it's simply not right, my excellent friend, for us to say that the soul is any kind of attunement, for then, it seems, we'd agree with neither divine Homer nor with ourselves. That's how it stands, he said. Well now, said Socrates, we seem to have appeased Harmonia of Thebes reasonably well. But what about Cadmus, Cebes? How are we going to win him over and with what argument? I think you'll find a way, said Cebes. At any rate, that argument you just gave against the attunement theory was a marvelous surprise to me. When Simmias was speaking and stuck on his problem, I really wondered whether anyone would be able to make any use of his argument at all. So it struck me as quite strange that it couldn't withstand even the very first attack of your argument. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if Cadmus's argument met the same fate. My good man, said Socrates, don't tempt fate, or some jealous power may overturn the argument we're about to make. Well, that's for the god to worry about. As for us, let's go at it Homeric style, closing in to see whether there's anything to what you say. Here then is the sum of what you're asking. You want it shown that our soul is indestructible and immortal, so that a philosopher on the point of dying, confident, and believing that after death he'll fare far better there than if he'd lived and died some other kind of life, won't be showing a foolish, empty-headed confidence. Showing that the soul is something strong and godlike, and that it existed even before we became human, doesn't in your view, so you say, prevent all of this from indicating merely that the soul is long-lasting and existed for some unimaginable stretch of time before, knowing and doing all sorts of things, but was no more immortal for that, and in fact its very entry into a human body was the beginning of its destruction, like a disease. And that it lives out this life in misery, and finally perishes altogether in what we call death. And you say it makes no difference to each of our individual fears whether it enters a body once or many times. For anyone who isn't foolish ought to be afraid if he can't give an account showing the soul is immortal and has no knowledge of it. Something like that, I think, Sebes, is what you're saying, and I'm deliberately going back over it several times so that nothing slips past us, and so you can add or take away anything you like. And Sebes said, no, there's nothing I want to take away or add right now. That is exactly what I'm saying. Then Socrates paused for a long while, considering something to himself, and said, it's no small thing you're after, Sebes, for it requires a full inquiry into the cause of coming to be and passing away generally. So if you like, I'll go through my own experience with these matters for you. Then, if anything I say strikes you as useful, you can use it toward persuading yourself of what you're arguing. Yes, said Sebes, I would like that. Then listen as I tell it. When I was young, Sebes, I had an extraordinary appetite for that kind of wisdom people call the study of nature. It seemed to me a magnificent thing to know the causes of each thing, why each thing comes to be, why it perishes, why it exists at all. And I kept flipping back and forth, examining questions like these first. Is it when heat and cold undergo some kind of fermentation, as some people said, that living things are formed together? And is it blood we think with, or air, or fire? Or none of these, but rather the brain that provides our senses of hearing and seeing and smelling. And out of these arise memory and belief. And out of memory and belief, once they've settled down, knowledge comes to be along these lines. And then again, examining how all these things perish, and studying the phenomena of the heavens and the earth, I ended up concluding that I was, if anything, spectacularly unsuited for this kind of inquiry. And I'll give you good enough proof of that. Matters I previously understood clearly enough, or so I thought, and so others thought too. I was, through this inquiry, so thoroughly blinded that I actually unlearned things I had thought I knew before, among many others, why a human being grows. That, I used to think, was obvious to anyone, because of eating and drinking. When from food, flesh is added to flesh and bone to bone, and in the same way each of the other parts gets its own proper matter added to it, then, I thought, the mass that was small later becomes large, and that's how a small person becomes a big one. That's what I used to think. Doesn't that seem reasonable to you? It does to me, said Sebes. Consider this too, then. I used to think it was reasonable enough that, whenever a tall man stood next to a short one, he'd appear taller by a head, and one horse taller than another the same way. And even more obviously than that. 10 seemed to me more than 8 because 2 had been added to it, and a 2-cubit length greater than a 1-cubit length because it exceeded it by half its own measure. Well, said Sebes, what do you think about all that now? I'm a long way, by Zeus, he said, from thinking I know the cause of any of that. I who don't even accept it of myself that when you add 1 to 1, either the one it was added to has become 2, or the one that was added, or that the one added and the one it was added to became 2 by the addition of the one to the other. I find it strange that when each of them was separate from the other, each was, presumably, 1 and they weren't 2 then, but once they came close to each other, this, their coming together, their being placed near one another, turned out to be the cause of their becoming 2. Nor again can I be persuaded that if you split 1 in 2, this, the splitting, has now become the cause of their being 2, for that's the opposite cause from the one before which made for becoming 2. Then it was because they were brought together near one another, and one was added to the other. Now it's because one is drawn apart and separated from the other. Nor can I any longer convince myself that I understand why a unit comes to be at all, nor, in a word, why anything else comes to be or perishes or exists, following this method of inquiry. But I've cobbled together some other approach of my own, haphazardly, and this old method I don't accept in any way at all. But once, hearing someone reading aloud from a book, by Anaxagoras, he said it was, and saying that it is mind that orders and is the cause of everything, I was delighted with this explanation, and it seemed to me in a way to be a good thing, that mind should be the cause of everything. And I thought that if this were so, then mind, in ordering everything, would order and arrange each thing in whatever way was best for it. So if anyone wanted to find the cause of anything, why it comes to be, perishes, or exists. What he'd need to find out about it was how it was best for it to be, or to undergo, or do anything else whatsoever. And by this reasoning, a person need consider nothing else about anything, himself included, except what is best and most excellent. Though necessarily the same person would also know what is worse, since the knowledge of both is the same. Reasoning this way, I was delighted to think I had found in Anaxagoras a teacher after my own mind about the cause of things, one who would tell me first whether the earth is flat or round, and having told me that, would go on to explain the cause and the necessity of it, telling me what was better, and that it was better for it to be such as it is. And if he said it was in the middle, he would go on to explain how it was better for it to be in the middle. And if he could show me all this, I was prepared never again to go looking for any other kind of cause. And so I had got myself ready to ask the same kind of question about the sun, and the moon, and the other stars, about their speeds relative to one another, their turnings, and whatever else happens to them, in what way it is better for each of them to act and be acted upon as it does. I never imagined that, having said mind arranged them, he would then bring in some other cause for them than that it is best for them to be as they are. So I thought that in assigning the cause for each of them, and for the whole together, he would go on to explain what is best for each and what is good for all in common. I wouldn't have sold my hopes for a great deal. No, I got hold of the books as eagerly as I could and read them as fast as I was able, so that I might know as soon as possible the best and the worst. Well, my friend, I was carried along from a marvelous hope, only to find, as I went on reading, a man making no use of mind at all, nor crediting it with any responsibility for ordering things, but instead blaming air and ether and water, and a great many other absurd things. It struck me as exactly like someone saying that Socrates does everything he does by mind, and then trying to give the causes of each of the things I do, saying first that the reason I'm sitting here now is that my body is made up of bones and sinews, and the bones are solid and have joints separating them from each other, while the sinews, being able to stretch and relax, wrap around the bones along with the flesh and the skin that holds them together. So since the bones hang loose at their joints, when the sinews slacken and tighten, they somehow make it possible for me to bend my limbs now, and that's why, bent up in this way, I'm sitting here. And he would give you other causes just like that for my talking with you, sounds, and air, and hearing, and a thousand other such things, never mentioning the true causes. That since the Athenians decided it was better to condemn me, for that very reason I in turn decided it was better to sit here, and more just to stay and submit to whatever penalty they order. Because, by the dog, I think these sinews and bones would long since have been off in Megara or among the Boeotians, carried there by their opinion of what's best, if I hadn't thought it more just and finer to submit to whatever penalty the city imposes rather than to flee and run away. To call things like that causes is altogether absurd. If someone said that without having such things as bones and sinews and the rest I have, I wouldn't be able to do what I've decided to do, he'd be speaking the truth. But to say that it's because of these things that I do what I do, and that I do it by mind rather than by choosing the best, would be a great and careless failure of argument. It amounts to being unable to distinguish between what the real cause is, and that without which the cause could never be a cause at all. Most people, groping around in the dark, as it were, seem to me to call that other thing by a name that doesn't belong to it, as though it were the cause itself. That's why one man wraps a vortex around the earth and makes the heavens hold it in place, while another props the air up under it like a flat kneading trough on a stand. But the power by which things are now arranged in the best possible way, that power they neither look for nor believe holds any divine strength. Instead, they think they'll someday discover an Atlas mightier and more immortal and holding everything together better than that. And they give no thought at all to the fact that it is truly the good and the fitting that binds and holds things together. Now I would gladly have become a student of that kind of cause, whatever it might be, from anyone at all. But since I was deprived of it and proved unable either to find it myself or to learn it from anyone else, do you want me, he said, to give you a demonstration of the second course I took in my search for the cause, Sebes? By all means, he said, I want that very much. Well then, he said, After I had given up examining things as they are, I thought I ought to be careful not to suffer what happens to people who watch and study an eclipse of the sun. Some of them ruin their eyes, unless they look at its image in water or something of that sort. I had some such thought myself, and I was afraid I might be blinded in my soul altogether by looking at things with my eyes and trying to grasp them with each of my senses. So it seemed to me I ought to take refuge in accounts and look for the truth of things within them. Now perhaps the way I compare it isn't quite right in one respect. I don't fully agree that someone who examines things in accounts is examining them in images any more than someone who examines them in facts. But at any rate, that's the direction I set out in. Taking as a foundation, each time whatever account I judge to be strongest, I set down as true whatever seems to me to agree with it, both concerning cause and concerning everything else that is, and whatever doesn't agree as not true. But I want to explain what I mean more clearly, since I don't think you follow me yet. No, by Zeus, said Sebes, not entirely. Well, he said, here's what I mean, nothing new, but the same things I've never stopped saying, both elsewhere and in the discussion we just had. I'm going to try to show you the kind of cause I've been working with, and I'll go back again to those much talked of things and start from them, taking as given that there is such a thing as the beautiful itself, by itself, and the good, and the great, and all the rest. If you grant me these and agree that they exist, I hope from them to show you the cause, and to discover that the soul is immortal. Well, said Sebes, since you have my agreement, you'd better not delay in finishing. Then look, he said, at what follows from that, and see if you agree with me. It seems to me that if there is anything beautiful besides the beautiful itself, it is beautiful for no other reason than that it shares in that beautiful. And I say the same of everything. Do you agree with that kind of cause? I agree, he said. Well then, he said, I no longer understand, and I can't recognize those other clever causes people give. If someone tells me that a thing is beautiful because it has a blooming color, or a shape, or anything else of that sort, I dismiss all that. It only confuses me, and I hold simply, plainly, and perhaps naively to this one point. That nothing else makes a thing beautiful except the presence of that beautiful, or its association, or however it may be attached, I won't insist on the exact manner. Only that it is by the beautiful that all beautiful things become beautiful. That seems to me the safest answer I can give, both to myself and to anyone else, and holding to it I believe I'll never fall. It's safe to answer, both for me and for anyone, that it is by the beautiful that beautiful things become beautiful. Don't you think so too? I do. And is it by greatness that great things are great, and greater things greater, and by smallness that smaller things are smaller?
Yes.
Then you too would not accept it if someone said that one person is taller than another by a head, and the shorter one shorter by that same head. You'd protest that all you mean is that whatever is greater than another is greater by nothing other than greatness, and is greater because of that, because of greatness. And whatever is smaller by nothing other than smallness, and is smaller because of that, because of smallness. For fear, I imagine, that some opposing argument might confront you. If you say someone is taller by a head, since then first, the greater would be greater by the very same thing that makes the smaller smaller. And further, a small thing, a head, would be what makes the taller person taller, and that would be a monstrosity, that something great should be great by something small. Wouldn't you be afraid of that? And Sebes laughed and said, I would. Then he said, wouldn't you be afraid to say that 10 is more than 8 by 2, and that this is the cause of its exceeding 8, rather than saying it's by number and because of number? And that a length of 2 cubits is greater than 1 cubit by half its length, rather than by magnitude? The same fear applies, surely. Certainly, he said. And what about this? If one is added to one, wouldn't you be wary of saying that the addition is the cause of there being two? Or, if one is split in two, that the splitting is the cause? Wouldn't you cry out loudly that you know of no other way anything comes to be except by partaking of the particular reality of whatever it is that it comes to share in? And that in these cases, you have no other cause for there coming to be two except partaking of two-ness? And that whatever is going to be two must partake of that? And whatever is going to be one must partake of oneness. And that you'd leave all this business of splittings and additions and other such cleverness aside. letting those wiser than yourself answer in those terms, while you being afraid, as the saying goes, of your own shadow and of your own inexperience, would cling to that safe foundation of your hypothesis and answer accordingly. But if someone attacked the hypothesis itself, you'd let it go and not answer until you'd examined what follows from it, to see whether the consequences agree with one another or not. And when you had to give an account of the hypothesis itself, you'd do it the same way, setting down another hypothesis in turn, whichever seemed best among the higher ones, until you arrived at something adequate, and you wouldn't muddle things together, the way debaters do, by talking at once about the starting point and about what follows from it, if indeed you wanted to discover something real. That kind of person, perhaps, gives no thought or care to that at all, clever enough, in their wisdom, to stir everything together and still manage to please themselves. But you, if you're a philosopher, would, I think, do as I say. What you say is entirely true, said both Simmias and Cebes together.
Yes, by Zeus, Phaedo, and rightly so, it seems to me astonishing how clearly he put that, even for someone with only a little understanding.
Quite so, Echecrates, and everyone present thought so too.
Yes, and so do we, who weren't there hearing it now, but what was said after that?
As I recall, once this had been granted to him, and it was agreed that each of the forms is something, and that other things, by partaking of them, take their name from them, he went on to ask, if that's how you put it, then whenever you say Simmias is taller than Socrates but shorter than Phaedo, don't you mean that both are present in Simmias at that time, both tallness and shortness? I do. But surely, he said, you agree that the statement Simmias exceeds Socrates is not in truth, as it's phrased in words. For Simmias doesn't naturally exceed him by being Simmias, but by the tallness he happens to have. Nor does he exceed Socrates because Socrates is Socrates, but because Socrates has smallness compared to his tallness. True. Nor again is he exceeded by Phaedo because Phaedo is Phaedo, but because Phaedo has tallness compared to Simmias's smallness. That's so. So Simmias comes to be called both small and tall, being between the two, presenting his smallness to be exceeded by the other's tallness, and offering his tallness to exceed the other's smallness. And smiling, he added, I seem to be talking like a book, but at any rate, that's how it is. Cebes agreed. I say this because I want you to see things as I do. It seems to me not only that tallness itself is never willing to be tall and short at once, but also that the tallness in us never admits smallness, nor is willing to be exceeded. Instead, one of two things happens. Either it flees and withdraws when its opposite, smallness, approaches, or it perishes at that approach. But it will not, by standing its ground and admitting smallness, become other than it was. Just as I myself, by admitting and standing my ground under smallness, and still being just who I am this same person, small, whereas that other thing, tallness, has not dared, being tall, to be small. In the same way, the smallness in us is never willing to become or to be tall, nor is any other opposite, while remaining what it was, willing at the same time to become and to be its opposite. Instead, it either withdraws or perishes in that very experience. That's exactly how it looks to me, said Cebes. And someone among those present on hearing this spoke up. I don't clearly remember who it was. By the gods, didn't we agree earlier in the discussion on the very opposite of what's being said now, that the bigger comes from the smaller and the smaller from the bigger, and that this is simply how opposites come to be, out of their opposites. But now it seems to me, we're saying that could never happen. Socrates turned his head toward him, listened, and said, bravely recalled. But you're not noticing the difference between what's being said now and what was said then. Back then we said that an opposite thing comes to be from an opposite thing. Now we're saying that the opposite itself could never become opposite to itself, neither the one in us nor the one in nature. Back then, my friend, we were talking about the things that have the opposites in them, calling them by the names of those opposites. Now we're talking about the opposites themselves, the ones whose presence gives the things their names. And it's these themselves, we say, that would never be willing to accept coming to be from one another. And with that he looked at Cebes and said, Cebes, did anything this man said trouble you too? No, not this time, said Cebes. though I don't deny that plenty of things do trouble me. So we've agreed on this without qualification, he said. An opposite will never be opposite to itself. Absolutely. Now consider this further point for me, he said, and see whether you'll agree. Is there something you call hot and something cold? There is. The same things as snow and fire. By Zeus, no. So the hot is something other than fire, and the cold something other than snow. Yes. But I think you'd grant this. Snow, being what it is, will never take in the hot, as we were saying before, and still be what it was, snow and hot as well. When the hot approaches, it will either get out of its way or be destroyed. Certainly. And fire, in turn, when the cold approaches it, will either withdraw or perish. It will never dare to take in coldness and still be what it was, fire and cold too. That's true, he said. Then it holds for some things of this kind, he said, that it's not only the form itself that's entitled to its own name for all time, but also something else, which is not the form yet always has its character whenever it exists. Maybe what I mean will be clearer in this example. The odd, presumably, must always get this name we're now giving it, right? Certainly. But is it the only thing that does this is my question, or is there something else, which is not the same as the odd, yet which we must always call by its own name and by this name, odd, too, because it's so constituted by nature that it's never separated from the odd. I mean the sort of thing that happens with the number three and with many other things. Look at the three. Doesn't it seem to you that it must always be addressed both by its own name and by the name of the odd, even though the odd is not the same as the three? Still, that's how the three and the five and the whole half of the number series are constituted. Each of them, without being what the odd is always odd. And again, two and four and the whole other column of number, without being what the even is, still each of them is always even. Do you grant this or not? Of course, he said. Then watch closely, he said, for what I want to make clear. It's this, it appears that not only do those opposites refuse to accept one another, but also whatever things, without being opposite to each other, always contain the opposites. These two, it seems, refuse to accept the character that's opposite to the one in them. When it advances, they either perish or retreat. Won't we say that three will be destroyed first, will suffer anything whatever, sooner than stay put and become even while still being three? Absolutely, said Siebes. And yet, he said, two is not the opposite of three. No, indeed. So it's not only the opposite forms that don't stand firm when they advance on each other. Certain other things too don't stand firm when the opposites advance. Very true, he said. Then do you want us to define, if we can, what kind of things these are? Certainly. Well then, Siebes, he said, would they be these? Whatever a thing takes hold of, it forces it to have not only its own character, but also always the character of some opposite. What do you mean? Just what we were saying a moment ago. You know, surely, that whatever the character of three takes hold of must be not only three, but also odd. Certainly. Then upon such a thing, we say, the character opposite to the form that produces this will never come. No. And what produced it was the odd. Yes. And opposite to this is the character of the even. Yes. So the character of the even will never come upon the three. No, indeed. So the three has no share in the even. None. So the three is uneven. Yes. Now for what I said we should define. What kind of things, without being opposite to something, nevertheless don't accept it, the opposite. For instance, just now, the three, though not opposite to the even, still doesn't accept it any more for that, since it always brings up the opposite against it. Likewise, the two against the odd, and fire against the cold, and a great many others. Well, see whether you define it this way. Not only does the opposite not accept its opposite, but also whatever brings up some opposite against that which it enters. The thing that brings it up will itself never accept the oppositeness of what it brings. Refresh your memory again. It does no harm to hear it more than once. Five won't accept the character of the even, nor ten. It's double, the character of the odd. This double, of course, is itself opposite to something else, but all the same it won't accept the character of the odd. Nor will one and a half and the other such things, the half, accept the character of the whole, and the third part likewise and everything of that sort, if you follow me and agree it's so. I agree entirely, he said, and I follow. Then tell me again from the beginning, he said. And don't answer me in the terms of my question, but do as I do. I say this because, beyond that first answer I described, the safe one, I now see another kind of safety arising from what we've just said. If you ask me what it is whose presence in a body makes it hot, I won't give you that safe, ignorant answer, heat, but a subtler one drawn from our present results, fire. And if you ask what it is whose presence in a body makes it sick, I won't say sickness, but fever. And what it is whose presence in a number makes it odd, I won't say oddness, but the unit, and so on. See whether by now you understand well enough what I want. Quite well enough, he said. Then answer, he said, what is it whose presence in a body makes it alive? Soul, he said. And is this always so? Of course, he said. So whatever the soul takes hold of, it always comes to it bringing life. It does indeed, he said. And is there something opposite to life or nothing? There is, he said. What? Death. Then the soul will never accept the opposite of what it always brings. That follows from what we agreed before. Most emphatically, said Siebes. Well then, what did we just now call the thing that doesn't accept the character of the even? Uneven, he said. And what doesn't accept the just, and whatever doesn't accept the musical? Unmusical, he said, and the other unjust. Good. And what do we call whatever doesn't accept death? Deathless, he said. And the soul doesn't accept death. No. So the soul is deathless. Deathless. Good, he said. Shall we say this has been proved? What do you think? Proved and very adequately, Socrates.